interview of Richard Moe for the Robert Mortvet Files. Performed April 13th, the year 2000.
There isn't, we don't need a microphone that picks it up.
Yes. Testing it out this morning.
So, just for the fun of it, let's see how it comes out now. How if the background noise is up.
Okay. Great. So, first, I would love to hear about your role at PLU when you were here and what you were involved with and the things you did.
Well, I came to PLU in 1965, September 1, as Dean of the College of Professional Studies. There was a Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, who was at that time Eck Knorr, and then Dr. Anderson took his place. And I think somebody will be interviewing him. The College of Professional Studies was the School of Business, the School of Education, the School of Nursing, the School of the Arts, and that became the School of Physical Education and Recreation. So I had these five school heads reporting to me. One of them was Dr. Zuloff, and Mrs. Morkin in nursing, and Dr. Utzinger in the arts, and Dr. Johnston in education, and then Dr. Olson in physical education. So in any case, Dr. Mortvet brought me here for an interview. I got a call. I was teaching at Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
Okay.
In June, he called up. And he said, we're looking for a dean, and you've been recommended. So in those days, that's the way you hired people. You didn't send out announcements all over the country asking for people to apply. You would contact people you knew and said, you know somebody who would be good here. And he had called Dr. Rand, who was the president of St. Olaf College, and asked him for a recommendation. And Dr. Rand, who had been my president when I was a dean at Waldorf College, said, Dick Moe is your man. So he called me and invited me to come out for interview. And I hadn't planned to leave Rock Island, Augustana College, because I loved it there, my wife loved it there. But when I decided, okay, I got a permission from the dean of the college that if I were to be offered a job at PLU, he would release me from my contract, because I'd already signed my contract for the next year. And so I came out and was very impressed with Dr. Mortvet and his wife Gladys. I remember they took me out to dinner that night, and we went to the Tacoma Club, which is a tall building downtown. And we sat in the corner, and Mount Rainier was absolutely spectacular in its beauty. And so that wowed me. But I think Dr. Mortvet may have been the chief reason I came. I was so impressed with this grand man. And I came home after the interview and told my wife that I really wanted to go, and she didn't want to come out here.
Oh, no.
Because she loved Rock Island, and she loved our new friends at Augustana College. So, but in any case, I persuaded her, and after about 2 hours of persuasion, I called Dr. Mortvet and said, I'm coming.
Cool.
So I came. And in fact, that first 3 weeks that we were here, we lived in their basement because the house that we had rented was not yet available for occupancy.
Wow.
So we lived in, and that was another way of getting to know him a little bit. He was a, I think as you know, a PhD in Middle English from Harvard. Extraordinarily well-educated, bright, brilliant man. Tall, he had gray hair by that time, stately looking, walked very upright with good posture, and was meticulous with his English. So when you wrote him a memo, you were meticulous with your English as well. Because his very being and his very presence seemed to evoke from you your very best. But when I was around him, I was at my best behavior and at my best use of English. Because it would be embarrassing to be anything other than very, very proper and right in his presence. He was just that kind of man who he didn't demand it personally, but his presence seemed to demand that you do things just right. So in talking about him to other people over the years, I mean, I use the word integrity. The integrity of that man was so clear-cut and visible and evident in all that he did, that there was no question about decisions we would make. If it was the right thing to do, that's what we would do. There was never not even any discussion or debate about making a decision that might be somewhat shady or questionable. In any case, we came, and he welcomed me, and then for the 3 years that he was president and I was here before he retired, I was a part of the President's Council, which consisted of Dean Buchanan, who was the Vice President for Finance, Dr. Langevin, who was at that time, Academic Vice President, Dr. Anderson, and myself. He was Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, and I was Dean of the College of Professional Studies. And then Dan Leisure, Dr. Leisure, who was Dean of Student Life, and his assistant, Lucille Giroux. And you haven't heard, have you heard the name of Lucille Giroux? She had been presidential secretary to Eastfold, who preceded Mortlet. Then she was Mortlet's executive secretary. Then she was Wiegman's executive secretary. Then she was executive secretary to Dr. Ricci when he came as president. And there was 1 year in the interim when Dr. Junkins, who was the provost under Wiegman and also under Ricci, who was acting president. So she was executive secretary to Eastfold, Mortfett, Wiegman, Junkins, Ricci.
Wow.
Yeah. By president. And she was a remarkable woman. She was always in our meetings and kept the minutes of the meetings. So that's a little bit of an introduction.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Let's see. How did you feel once you were established in your house and everything like that, that your relationship with Dr. Mortlet seemed to grow, or how did you see him working with others?
I held him in awe all the time, more so than anybody I can remember, because he was that kind of a man. But we had a very good relationship. I always called him President Mortfett. He called me Dean Moe sometimes, but a lot of the times he called me Dick. And it was a cordial relationship where I could go in at any time to talk to him if I needed to about something. But most of the time our togetherness was in the President's Council, which met every Monday morning. Or at events in the evening, concerts, receptions following the council. Because he did enjoy hearing choirs sing, the orchestra played. He didn't like theater as much because he couldn't hear very well. He was starting to lose his hearing. And it's hard to hear in Eastfold Auditorium when you go to a play.
Right.
So I think he didn't go to as many plays. But he was very appreciative of the arts and supportive of the arts. One of his best friends was a painter at Montana State University. And that person had influenced his taste in art. But I would say our relationship was always cordial. He liked books. There was one incident that I can remember when I had read a book called Ring of Truth by C.S. Lewis. I think it was.
Okay.
A really nifty book about religious matters. And when I read it, I thought, I bet you Dr. Moore would like that book. So one day I brought it to his office with a signed copy to my friend and colleague, Dr. Morfitt.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't more than 2 days later that he called up and just was effusive in his thanks to me for giving him this wonderful book that he had read thoroughly from cover to cover.
Yeah.
And he made mention of that a couple of times in public places, how appreciative he was of Dean Moe for his thoughtfulness in giving him this wonderful book to read.
Wow.
So he was always willing to be complimentary and supportive,
mm-hmm.
To make you feel as though what you were doing was appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that he, until the moment he retired, acted very much the same. Just he was straight. I mean, a Mr. Straight.
Mm-hmm.
But occasionally, he would laugh at a story, but somehow you didn't feel as though he wanted to waste his time with any frivolity,
mm-hmm.
because he was always so focused and serious on doing what he did. He was a busy man raising money to deal with the faculty. He used to like to read the comics.
Mm-hmm.
But when he came to PLU and became president, he said, I just didn't have time for it. So I gave up the comics.
Wow.
Because I didn't have time to read them. So, but anyway, it was, of course, there were, all, in a life of a president, the whole institution is his challenge and his field of operation. Whether it's students or mm-hmm. faculty or alumni or friends or donors, mm-hmm. the community, you work to, in a sense, interact with and become a part of the larger whole. And the hardest part for him was reaching out into the community,
mm-hmm.
because that was a lesser priority for him than dealing with on campus things,
mm-hmm.
like students and faculty,
right.
and the Board of Regents.
Okay.
But he wanted very much for this campus to grow and be developed into a beautiful campus.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the Morfitt Library was one of the things that that he accomplished,
mm-hmm.
and it was named after him. But even the whole plan for the campus was developed kind of under the leadership of Dean Buchanan, who was the Vice President for Finance. Oh, another one in those meetings, forgot to mention, Clayton Peterson was the Vice President for Development. That's
okay.
Right. In our President's Council, going back to when I mentioned
mm-hmm.
who was there, Clayton Peterson, Vice President for Development, was always there. But the plan for the campus, to end up planting the trees that are now so evident,
mm-hmm.
was developed under Dr. Morfitt. Dean Buchanan being the leading player, because that was kind of his job as Vice President for Finance and
mm-hmm.
Operations, because he oversaw the buildings and grounds.
Mm-hmm.
So Morfitt was busy with that, and we accomplished a whole lot then, which is now very evident today. I mean, the campus is a beautiful campus.
Oh, yes.
And up until Dr. Morfitt, there had never been a real long-range plan for developing the campus.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Eastwell before him was so busy raising money that he didn't really devote much effort to how to make the campus a beautiful place.
Mm-hmm. Now, at that time, was the lower campus as developed as the upper area, or was that more?
No, let's see. The lower campus had one building, and that was, two. Columbia Center was there,
okay.
and Memorial Gym. And I think the swimming pool was built during Morfitt's first or second year here.
Okay.
Yes. But Memorial Gym, so Olson Auditorium wasn't there,
mm-hmm.
Tinglestad Hall wasn't there. Foss and Flieger were built under Morfitt's
mm-hmm.
regime.
Yeah, I read a little bit.
Yeah. So, but when he came, the Memorial Gym was the only building down there.
Hmm.
But now it's got the Reiki Science,
and
the Tinglestead, and the swimming pool, and the math building, and now the observatory, and more is to come. Well, of course, now also the new
South Hall. Yes, it's such a big building. It seems every time I see it, it's just
huge,
larger and larger.
So, but he had a vision for what it could become, and then since then it's been modified. I think everybody, every year, every president takes a new look at it and wonders if there are things that could be done. Wheeler Street, I think that was closed off the year before I came here. But that was part of the plan too, to close off Wheeler. So that the mall, which you now walk on from Ingram Hall to the library, that was a street that went right through there.
Wow. That was, and that was
Wheeler Street.
Wow.
That now it comes dead end. When you come up from Spanaway Beach Road on Wheeler,
right.
Now you have to turn and go over to 125th Street. But so when Dr. Mortford's leadership, we got that street closed off, and that allowed us then to make some of the beautiful moves that we did on the campus.
And to expand on that other side of the road a little there, too.
I'm sorry?
To expand on that.
Right.
Did they have buildings on both sides of that street prior to closing it off, or was that?
The houses were only on the north side.
Okay.
And they were moved out. And then, of course, that made room for Steuben Hall and Ordahl Hall. And what is now called Ingram Hall was there then.
Oh, okay.
But it was a temporary building built right after World War II with the intention of it being destroyed in 20 years. It was a 20-year life building.
Uh-huh.
And now it's still here today. 50 years later, and it's pretty, we even remodeled it and made it a little more effective, but that wasn't done under Dr. Mortford.
Okay.
So it's off the subject.
Right.
Do you have any other questions?
About the library, was when he decided, or when they decided that they would like to put it up in that corner, do you know if there was a lot of discussion about where they were going to put the library to work with
you? You know, I can't answer that question.
Okay.
I don't think so. I think we looked around and wanted to find a place that would be kind of, if not central, easily accessed by everybody.
Right. Okay.
That was important. To Dr. Mortford, the most important building on the campus was the library.
Mm-hmm.
And the library that we had, it was, you know where it was before?
Mm-hmm.
It was in Xavier Hall.
Wow.
That was the library. Xavier.
Wow.
And the big room, that was the reading room in the library, and then the offices on the west end with low ceilings, they were the stacks.
Wow.
So that was the library, and a really inadequate space for a growing library, for a growing university. So the new library was his burning desire and his zeal for raising that money. And fortunately, the Regents chose to name it the Robert Mortford Library because it couldn't have been named after a more appropriate one. I mean, he was a scholar, and to him the library was just absolutely crucial, and so he supported it. The librarian at the time was Frank Haley, who was the son of Mr. Haley of Brown Haley Candy Company.
Oh, wow.
And, he was a wonderful guy who can just stop that a jiffy.
You were talking about the library and they were naming it after.
Okay. So the planning of the library was very, very interesting, and Dr. Mortford got more involved, I think, than he would have in any other building because it was just so important to him.
Yeah.
And one of the very wise decisions that were made at that time, one of the many, was to build it in such a way that you could add a story.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know.
Is it the third floor?
The third floor. Now, that was done before you got here, probably?
Yes.
Yeah. But in our library is a marvelous library.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I'm going to go there when we're done with our interview just to, just to walk in. I used to love to just walk in that place and feel the ambiance of the place that houses great books.
Yes.
And lots of good memories. So anyway, the library was built, and Dr. Mortfit brought in, for the dedicatory speech, Dr. Jaroslav Pelikan, who was at that time teaching theology at the Yale Divinity School.
Okay.
And Jaroslav Pelikan was one of the great Lutheran theologians. And I'll never forget his address, the library, colon, a repository of the soul. He came back, that was over 20 years ago, when he gave the first one, and he came back for the 10th anniversary and lectured again.
Wow.
But, so anyway, the library got built, and it's a real monument to Dr. Mortfit, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Then just a couple of sidelights that I
okay.
think of. Have you gone to a commencement yet?
No.
Here at PLU?
No, a graduation.
Yeah.
No, I'll be in it this year.
You will?
Yes.
Well, we have wonderful commencements.
Okay.
Processions, faculty, students, and they've always had that, but we also now have banners,
mm-hmm.
and the first real procession that I can remember at PLU was when the Archbishop of Canterbury came here.
Oh, wow.
Archbishop Michael Ramsey, and that must have been maybe in 1966, I think. And he was a large man, and he wore all of the attire
uh-huh.
of the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he spoke in chapel. It was in Eastville then. That was the only large auditorium we had.
Mm-hmm.
And in any case, his talk was really significant, and I don't remember a lot of talks I've heard, but I remember his, at least the essence of it.
Right.
And he talked to the students, and he said, the new American university is a wonderful place because you students are able to participate in it. You're able now, in these recent years, to be seated on the Board of Regents or have opportunity to give input for how you want it to change. At my university, Oxford,
mm-hmm.
that is not the case. Students come here to get the pearls of wisdom that come out of the mouths of faculty, but they don't participate in the university. They just are like dogs getting the crumbs off the table. And
wow.
It was for the students, it was just a very awe-inspiring talk,
yeah.
because those were the days of Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and when the student movement really was gaining ground, and the Archbishop highlighted that and spoke of the wonderful opportunity that new students here at Pacific Lutheran University have. Well, I mention that because it leads into, I think, why Dr. Morton chose to retire maybe earlier mm-hmm. than he might otherwise, because the student demands for participation,
mm-hmm.
for being on the Board of Regents, this ran totally counter to his concept of how you run a university. And that's not the way it's supposed to be run, you know, by people who know what a university is
mm-hmm.
and who bring the wisdom of the ages to. And the idea that he would have to share any kind of leadership or be somehow bound by student input as
mm-hmm.
to how to run a university was just something that he was not able, or chose not to deal with. So rather than in a sense become a new kind of creature from what
mm-hmm.
he was, he decided to retire. He was also, I think, losing a little bit of hearing.
Mm-hmm.
But he continued in good health for several years afterwards. He loved to fish,
mm-hmm.
wonderful fly fisherman. And sometimes, on occasion, in one of our President's Council meetings, he might comment about the great fish that got away that last Saturday when he was out fishing. But I've never seen pictures of him and his waders, and he loved to tie flies and go fishing. So when he retired, the Board of Regents chipped in and gave him a little a van with a for fishing, so you can go out and sleep in that cab above the pickup and fish. So, but I guess, I think of my memories of him are in his crimson doctoral robe with the black velvet.
Stripes
on the side, and Harvard's color crimson.
Okay.
So, and he had a black velvet cap, and walking with the symbol of the university around his neck, a kind of, what do you want to call it?
A stole, sort of?
Well, a stole, but the metal, like not a cross, but it was the university, some kind of metal that had been created for the present. The present war.
Okay.
Walking in procession with the Archbishop of Canterbury and at subsequent commencements. And then that tradition followed when Dr. Wiegman succeeded him.
Mm-hmm.
He commissioned one of our music faculty members to create the Procession of Joy, which now has been used at every commencement since, and the parades and the banners.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that kind of first got initiated when the Archbishop of Canterbury came and marched with Dr. Mortford in that procession. And you'll experience that at commencement this year when you march. And when you enter Olson Auditorium and the orchestra is playing this wonderful commencement march, it's called Procession of Joy. Wonderful piece. The guy who wrote it is now dead. He was a professor of composition back in the 60s and 70s.
Oh, sounds wonderful.
So what else?
Well, concerning actually his retirement, in some of the letters that I had been able to look over in the archives and things like that, it had really...
What else?
Well, concerning actually his retirement, in some of the letters that I had been able to look over in the archives and things like that, it had really, to me, also seemed apparent that he was very sad about the changes going on on the campus. And then another one of the girls in the class that was reading the MAST articles made it sound like the students really took charge of wanting to be involved in things. I guess. So when you were mentioning that you feel that he retired a lot largely due to not wanting to change that way, I guess, do you have any other thoughts concerning that? Like, I think that's very interesting, just that there was this man of great integrity, and it was. Do you feel that it hurt, like, or not hurt, but almost broke his heart seeing the changes? Like,
that's a good question. And you know, I really. Can't remember all the workings. I remember vividly the new president coming in, who was Dr. Wiegman, who came in with mixed raves. Some people were delighted, some people were very sad, because he was very tuned in to the students.
Right.
He came out of Washington, D.C., and immediately put students on the Board of Regents and spent time going to the dormitories listening to them, because he knew that that was something that had to be done. I mean, students weren't going to sit back and be ignored.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't even remember how old Dr. Mortford was. Do you know how old he was when he retired?
No.
I suspect he was past 65. I think so. But in any case, I know is that that it became increasingly difficult for him to implement the kind of ideas that he held dear over a long lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a year there?
Let me see.
What year was
1969 he retired.
What year was he born?
1902.
Okay, so he was 67, all right. So when he retired, it was, everybody just assumed he was retiring.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think people outside the university had any sense that he was doing it because of unwillingness to change his presidential style.
Mm-hmm.
But those of us who were on the inside knew very well that it was just not going to, he knew that it wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was a smart man, and instead of compromising what he thought were his principles,
mm-hmm.
he resigned, which is what you would have expected him to do.
Mm-hmm.
And had he not done that, had he held on vigorously and ignored student requests to become members of the regents or to have advisory councils, we would have had a lot of trouble on campus.
Lots of conflict between.
Yeah. And so, in any case, he made the decision to retire. And he retired with great grandeur, and everybody was just so grateful to him for what he had done.
Mm-hmm.
Because he took the university
mm-hmm.
from it being a kind of Bible school, parochial school in Parkland
mm-hmm.
that didn't have much credibility
mm-hmm.
out in the larger world, from being a kind of parochial, isolated place into becoming a significant, distinguished university. And that's what he talked about. He wanted us to become a distinguished university.
Mm-hmm.
And he led the way on that, hiring faculty. He just looked for PhDs in the prior years. I think many times people were brought in, retired preachers who were friends of the president,
mm-hmm.
who came in to teach history or whatever,
oh, mm-hmm.
and wanted qualified PhDs
mm-hmm.
to bring academic stature to the institution. And that began. And the library was important as a
mm-hmm.
part of that whole idea, and the whole tradition of becoming a distinguished university kind of caught on, and the feeling was very apparent on the part of those of us who were here, that we were really doing everything we could to become a great university.
Mm-hmm.
And I just attribute that spirit and that mode of thinking to Dr. Morfitt. I mean, it was just so important to him. And you knew it in his talks at chapel.
Mm-hmm.
You never had to worry about or wonder where he was coming from. You knew
mm-hmm.
where he was coming from. He was articulate and to the point and clear as can be that this is what he expected us
mm-hmm.
to be the best and to seek to achieve the best. Yeah. Huh. I hadn't thought about that for a long time now until I talked to you. But it came through in all ways, in many, many ways,
mm.
that you just worked to be your very best because you weren't going to disappoint Dr. Morfitt.
Yeah. And, wow. I found that same that you're mentioning, it seemed so apparent too in his correspondence.
Mm.
There was one letter that I read where he was apologizing to someone because he wouldn't be there to greet them when they arrived.
Mm.
And I think after he mentioned that he wouldn't be able to be there, then he said that he hoped such a grievance would never be his again. And,
mm.
and where with some people you might think he was just saying that, it really seemed like he passionately
yes.
felt
oh, yeah.
great. Mm-hmm. He was greatly upset that he wasn't going to be there. And, yeah.
So, well.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Do you have any other thoughts and just general anything?
Well, let's see. Of course, my wife, Lila, who died, really liked him a lot, and he liked her a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He liked Lila. Well, everybody liked Lila. My wife died tragically
mm-hmm.
in her home. She was murdered in her home right down here on Garfield Street 23
oh.
years ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And but just thinking about him, his wife Gladys was always so cordial and kind and thoughtful. But whenever we were out someplace and he saw Lila, he'd come over and say, "Oh, Lila, it's so good to see you," and he'd give her a hug. And she liked that, because she liked him too.
Mm-hmm.
And then, after he retired, I saw him, not frequently, but maybe 4 or 5 times a year. Mm-hmm. And the first time I saw him, I said, "Hello, Dr. Mortfit." And he said to me, "My name's Bob," which was his way of saying, "You don't have to call me Dr. Mortfit anymore." But when he was the president, I always did.
Uh-huh.
Then thinking about that, he was the last one that we did that to. Wiglin came in, he was Gene. Enrique came in, and he was Bill. Well, in formal situations, there would be President Enrique, mm-hmm. President Wiglin. But as dean, it was very clear that they wanted me to call him Bill or Gene, mm-hmm. or Lauren, mm-hmm. Anderson. But they wouldn't have thought of calling Dr. Mortfit Bob, you know. Because in those days, you in a respected position by using the proper term or,
mm-hmm.
Or address. And it wasn't difficult. He was President Mortfit or Dr. Mortfit. So, but just talking about here brings back a lot of happy memories that I'm glad he brought me here. And my wife became pleased that she came here also, but it took her a while to give up her wonderful life that she had enjoyed at Augustana College in Rock Island.
Mm-hmm.
Her daughters loved it here, and they liked Dr. Mortfit. He was always kind to them.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't go to Peoria. One went to Augsburg College, one went to St. Olaf.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe my grandchildren will come here. I hope so. But Peoria is a great place, I think, today. And Dr. Mortfit was one of the key people in helping to make it that way. So,
great.
Thanks for asking me.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for doing this. I appreciate it so much.